Good morning and welcome to Sports Interview with Ann Liguori on this Saturday morning. How are we doing this morning? So glad you can join me where I am every Saturday morning right here on WLIW 88.3 FM Southampton, serving Eastern Long Island and Southern Connecticut, 96.9 in Western Suffolk, and streaming at WLIW.org/radio and on your favorite streaming platforms. And each show is archived on my website at annliguori.com. That's annliguori.com. And distributed on my podcast via Audioboom and iTunes. Well, the big story at this upcoming U.S. Tennis Championship is that the legendary Serena Williams will be stepping down after this major championship, capping a 28-year professional career in which she earned 23 major singles titles, 39 combined major titles, including singles, mixed doubles, and women's doubles, 2 Serena Slams, and a gold medal in singles, and 3 gold medals in doubles. Her impact on and off the court have been far-reaching, opening doors for men and women of color, inspiring a generation of people, young and old, with her success from a young girl growing up in Compton, California, to the superstar mom, player, and businesswoman she is today. Well, this morning, Randy Walker, longtime colleague in the field of tennis, who spent a lifetime in the world of tennis as a former PR rep for the USTA. He's a publisher of tennis books, an author, a tennis historian. We'll talk about Serena Williams and her legacy in this show. And in the first half of the show, sports conditioning and nutrition coach Damon Goddard will share the work that he is doing with PGA stars such as Jordan Spieth, Will Zalatoris, and Davis Riley. With mantras such as movement is medicine, you'll be sure to pick up several pointers from Damon Goddard that you can use for your own life to help maximize your fitness, nutrition, and reduce the risk of injuries. Hope you enjoy this edition of Sports Interview with Ann Liguori. All you golf fans know that Will Zalatoris won his very first PGA Tour title last week in a 3-hole playoff. And joining me now is Damon Goddard, Will's sports performance and nutrition coach. And Damon is a leading expert in golf performance conditioning and post-rehab and nutrition. And it's a pleasure to talk with you, Damon. Welcome to Talking Golf.
No, I'm honored to be on here. And thank you for the invite.
You and I met at the U.S. Open at the Country Club of Brookline, and you were working at the time with Jordan Spieth and Will and Davis Riley, and I know you have clients in other sports as well, but let's focus on your work with these golfers. If you could explain to my audience what exactly you do with these golfers and how helpful you can be to them.
No, I'll try to simplify it. My role in this entire golf performance spectrum, listen, these guys have so many members to their team now, and we all work in tandem. And so what I do from the golf side is I really want to make sure that the machine is operating optimally. And so we do that through strength and conditioning. We do that through recovery protocols. We do that through nutrition and monitoring a lot of the external variables that come into play for things that may inhibit their performance. And so my role is to continually be on task with the athlete in order to make them optimally perform every single week.
All right. Well, these guys perform every single week. It's a grueling schedule. And, you know, just in terms of Will Zalatoris, I mean, he's had 3 runner-up finishes in the majors. In the 2021 Masters, he finished 2nd to Hideki Matsuyama. This year in January, he lost to Luke Liss in the playoffs. And, in the Farmers Insurance Open, he was so close. Lost to JT in a 3-hole playoff at the PGA Championship, tied for 2nd at the U.S. Open, and he finally emerged as the victor at the tournament, the St. Jude's Classic in Memphis. So first of all, you must feel so joyful for him because you've been part of his team for a while now, right?
No, I mean, listen, obviously I love to see the success of the athletes. And then, that's always a byproduct of the work that's always put in. It's kind of like what I always say to these guys is winning is just a little byproduct of the preparation that nobody sees, right? And to see Will in such a short amount of time have so much success within, a very short career on the PGA so far. A lot of people forget that it's just been, about a year, a little over a year, almost 2 years while he's been playing. And so this is actually a pretty quick little win, and the success he's had on it so far has been outstanding. And it's always fun to see. Listen, I'll take second places too. It's better than missing the cut. But to see him finally hoist a trophy, it was a very proud moment. Something that I know he's been diligently working on, and something that we've been, putting together as an entire team. And to see it come to fruition is just unbelievable.
So what exactly have you been working on with Will? Give us some insight, if you would, with what these players go through on a day-to-day basis to be the best they can be.
Oh my gosh. I mean, so much goes into it, and a lot of people don't realize the, all the variables that come into play with these guys. It's, the travel, the new hotels, the nutrition, the hydration, the conditioning, the recovery stuff. A lot of it comes into play in order just to be able to hit a simple white ball into a hole as few times as the competition. So, with what we're doing with Will, we've had a concerted effort over this past year to year and a half of. We knew, listen, he's got a, very skinny frame when he came in, and we are taking a look at, okay, I not only want success, soon, but I have to take a look at, and then the team has to take a look at the 15 to 20 year career that we're going to have with this guy. And so how do we prepare that athlete to reduce the risk of injury, number one, but to be able to withstand the rigors of just being a professional athlete. And so with him in particular, one of the biggest things we want to do is we actually wanted to gain some weight on him, right? And so that's, been a big discussion of, gaining 15 to 20 pounds with Will. But you got to realize that that's been over a good year and a half time frame, right? And so it just didn't happen overnight. By doing that via nutrition, via conditioning, being very concerted in our efforts throughout the year to, be able to push to the edge of the cliff, but not push over the edge to where he still can be able to perform day in and day out. And what we see on Thursday and Sunday, what we'd not realize is there's a lot of demand on these guys on, Mondays and Tuesdays and Wednesdays as well. So, I mean, they're grinding week in, week out. Then they're going to have obligations when they come back home as well. And so take all that in consideration, and we go, okay, how can I keep this machine operating throughout a very long year is going to be very paramount for us. So with Will in particular, he's done a phenomenal job of sticking to the program in terms of his conditioning program, sticking to all the recovery protocols, sticking to his nutrition as well. He's a very disciplined athlete, which, once again, byproduct of that is being able to get the second places and get the first places. And so that, you take an athlete like Will, who's very disciplined like that. It's nice to deal with an athlete like that.
Absolutely. I mean, I didn't realize he was 6 foot 2, and he's what, 175 pounds now?
Yeah, we'll undulate right now between 178, 175. Yeah, absolutely. And the key thing for us is trying to maintain that weight, especially in the, summertime, especially with, being back to back with a lot of our tournaments as well. It's a grind to be able to maintain that weight, especially on a framework like that. A lot of guys in his line of business will lose a lot of weight during the, grind of the summertime. So for him to be able to stick to it throughout the summertime, but throughout the kind of tail end of the season as well, has been pretty awesome.
And so how do you increase that muscle weight with somebody like him?
With him, I mean, it's interesting because most of us have the concern of trying to lose weight, right? And it's not easy to get a guy like that to gain weight. But some of the things that we're going to take a look at, whether we're increasing his protein intake, we're increasing some of his supplementation, but quite honestly, and I don't want to simplify it, Because to be able to elicit 1 to 2% of performance out of an elite athlete like that's not an easy task. But you know, for our listeners and for you and I, and with a guy like Will, we really kind of pick on the low hanging fruit. And we go, okay, what are our sleep patterns looking like? What are our nutritional patterns? What are our hydrations? What are our stress management protocols? You know, how are those looking throughout the day, and how are we managing that, right? And so literally anybody that wants to lose weight or even gain weight, if I've got poor quality of sleep, my body's just going to be wreaking havoc and not, operating on a full tilt. So a simple thing like, sleep and optimizing stress management and being concerted with my nutrition and hydration, those are low hanging fruit that I know we can accomplish. Especially for you and I and just everyday individuals, but for a guy like Will, if we can optimize the sleep patterns, get better sleep quality, stress management is much better. We put things into play to help stress management, really optimize the nutrition. Then I know it's going to be a lot easier when we get the low hanging fruit to then get the high hanging fruit and get really dirty detailed in how we can increase weight or decrease weight or just really simply keep it optimized at an even keel throughout the year.
I mean, you have to look at so many different factors, and everybody's so individualistic, right? So, what works for Will Zalatoris, who has a completely different body frame than, say, Jordan Spieth, they're so different. So, each person has a totally different program, and you have many certifications in fitness, nutrition. I bet even psychology, because that plays into it as well, as far as stress release
Oh,
and all of
yeah.
that. So, I mean, talk a little bit about your background, Damon.
Oh gosh. So I've been in the sports performance world for about 23 years, and been able to be able to work with the majority of that career with a lot of the PGA players, LPGA at the high level on the golf side. But I also dabble into the working with the professional basketball side. I had professional baseball. And I'm an avid learner anyways, and so to me, quite honestly, from the family background being all in academics anyways, really the moment that you stop learning is the moment you stop teaching. And so my thirst for continual pursuit of that education is number one, I've got to do a great service to my athletes, especially if they're going to be number one, number two, number three in the world eventually. They're coming to me for precise information. So I need to be really sniper level with the information that I'm going to be giving these guys and girls. And so that's what's really the thrust to me is stay on top of the game academically in order to be able to then relay that onto the athlete to get them to the highest level as well. So just an avid learner constantly. And then listen, I love sports. I love being around athletes. There's just something to it. But it's not a simple thing of just hitting a white ball or shooting a ball through a hoop. These guys have a great opportunity to play a sport to then make an impact off of the course, off of the court, to really be able to impact a lot of lives. And I mean, let's not kid ourselves, winning helps that and it gives them a better platform. I think that's more of the thrust behind why I do what I do is to be able to get them to a level that they can play to then be able to make a bigger impact globally.
And you look at the physical stature of some of the top golfers in the world, and here Will Zalatoris is, as you say, I think you told me you helped him maybe put on 20, 25 pounds in the last year, and I guess the challenge is for him to keep that weight on, right?
Absolutely.
And then obviously he's used to being at a certain weight, so that's a lot of weight to put on for somebody, so you have to kind of. That might change his swing. It might change his tempo. I mean, you have to think of all of that as well, right?
For sure. And even conversely, when we're losing weight, that's why, we can't have these visions of grandeur where it's going to happen overnight. The body is absolutely beautiful and it has this great ability to be very adaptive to whatever I'm introducing it to. And so whether that be losing weight or gaining weight, it has to be done over incremental time. And so, with visions of grandeur of saying losing 20 pounds in 3 months, it's probably not realistic. Gaining 20 pounds in 3 months, definitely not realistic. And so that's where, we will either gain the weight, have the body adapt, gain the weight, have the body adapt, gain the weight, body adapt, same thing, same principle with trying to lose weight. But when we're taking a look at professional athlete, there's a lot of what we'll call triggers that either from a mechanical standpoint, a nutrition standpoint, the toxins that were introduced, the site, you mentioned the psychological triggers, environmental, my immune system. There's a lot of triggers that will try to derail me from gaining weight or even losing weight. So we've got to understand how we can mitigate some of these triggers in order to stay at a good level for the machine to operate effectively. And so all of us really kind of need to take a look at that and go, what is around me environmentally, that may be a trigger for my body not to operate in an optimal way. Nutritionally, what do I need to kind of clean up in order to let my body operate effectively? Or even, functionally, my body, right? If I'm dealing with old injuries, well, maybe I need to go get those addressed so I can move efficiently. I mean, listen, movement is medicine. And so if the body can't move effectively, it's going to have an impact on the entire system, right? And so you got to take a look at that as an athlete. You go, all of my systems, I need to play well together. How can I optimize every system that we have?
Obviously, your goals include helping your clients perform at the highest level, but you're also reducing the risk of injury. So that's a fine line right there.
No, for sure. And that's why we're always very precise with our testing, and we're doing some mechanical testing, whether it be through movement efficiency testing. I always need to see how the athlete is moving in order to predict where there may be tight, weak, or asymmetrical movements that are creating potential injuries. But even nutritionally, I got to take a look at a lot of the blood work as well and see what's going on in blood work. And so throughout the year, we're constantly looking under the hood to see how this thing is operating. And we leave things out of the guesswork world. I cannot guess with an athlete like this, and really for any client, I don't like guesswork because what may have worked with a Jordan definitely might not work with a Will, right? Or a Davis or one of my basketball guys. Because each one of us have a beautiful fingerprint of how we operate. And so all of our systems move differently. And so we need to take those into consideration. And that's why, getting with professionals that, whether that be a nutritional coach or a functional medicine doc or, someone that have a real hands-on movement specialist like myself, any kind of performance coach, or get very specific with people that I need to see in order to then help me operate more effectively. And I think we try to fix a lot of it on ourselves when there's a lot of resources out there that we can use to help us operate very effectively.
Well, it certainly is working with your guys. Interesting, with your level of expertise, I'd love to hear your comments. Do you think Tiger, who suffered, so many back injuries and knee injuries and constantly, just one injury after another throughout his career, yet he continued to play and win? Is there any way, do you think, Tiger could have avoided these injuries that he endured?
Yeah, that's such it's a good question, and it's a catch-22 question, right? Could he probably have avoided a lot of injuries? Yeah, but we also have to take into consideration Tiger Woods' personality. Even on in the gym, he wanted to go, go, go. In the on course, he needed to just attack, attack, attack on course. And so it's interesting, you take the mindset of that and you go, well, if we had such a concerted effort to avoid a lot of injuries, would Tiger have been Tiger, right? And so it's a catch-22 question because you never know if he actually took a year off. And listen, he had great teams around him the whole time, but at the same time, there is an emotional income to a lot of people's operating mechanism. Let's say, for him, I mean, he loved to do a lot of Navy SEAL training. Is that good for the general public? Probably not. Is that good for a lot of professional athletes? No. But there was an emotional income from that then drove him to be the best out on the course.
Well, I could go on and on with you, David, but I really appreciate your insight here. And if people want to learn more about you and your work with athletes, where can they visit?
Yeah, they can go to the website Goddard SPN. That's GoddardSPN.com, or go to the Instagram at Goddard SPN as well, and they can follow me doing all the fun stuff on tour and with my athletes. And every now and then, I like to show my cute boys and my beautiful fiance on the Instagram as well, so they can keep up with all of that.
Well, continued success with Will Zalatoris and Davis Riley. And we're rooting for Jordan Spieth. He's one of our favorites and would love to see him get in the winner's circle again.
Absolutely. No, I appreciate you inviting me, and this is always fun. I love talking golf and talking performance all the time anyways.
Damon Goddard, thanks so much. Welcome back to Sports Interview with Anne Liguori, and it is my pleasure to say hello to longtime colleague and professional in the tennis world, Randy Walker, author, publisher, just really a renaissance man, Randy. You've done it all in the sport of tennis. Welcome to Sports Interview.
Thank you, Anne. It's always a pleasure to talk tennis with you and golf.
And tennis and golf. You're a big sports fan. I know you even love college football as well. But let's focus on Serena Williams, as she announced that this U.S. Open will be her very last competitive tournament. She's retiring after the 2022 U.S. Open. And in your perspective, because we all have our own perspectives, and, you know, you and I have been covering tennis for a very long time, but in your perspective, Randy, what is the impact that Serena Williams has had on the game on and off the court? I know that's a huge question and you could go on forever, but boy, what a huge impact this woman has made in tennis.
Well, you know, she's really brought tennis to the mainstream. You know, I mean, people who are not necessarily tennis fans are Serena Williams fans. And whenever she would have a spectacular victory or a crushing, controversial defeat, every person on every street corner knew about it. You know, so, I mean, just, it, you know, you look at the, you know, in recent times with social media, just how viral her wins and her defeats were, and it became, you know, literally like headline news on CNN when, you know, she would have a controversial loss or a huge win, you know. But obviously, I mean, she's you know, won 23 major championships. She's, you know, considered you know, one of the greatest of all time, if not the greatest of all time. So yeah, it's really the end of an era.
It really is. And as I wrote in a column for Dan's Papers, it's sentimental for me. I'm sure for you as well. I mean, I have covered every U.S. Open title that she's won, which is six, and probably most of her matches on the Arthur Ashe Stadium court since she's been playing the U.S. Open, which is a couple of decades now. And, you know, she won her first major title at the 1999 U.S. Open as a 17-year-old. I'll never forget, with her white beads in her hair, and she upset top-ranked Martina Hingis in straight sets, and she became the first Black woman to win a slam singles title in the open air. What are your memories of that match, Randy?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, just going back to the early days of Venus and Serena, I think people kind of forget that the hype used to be all about Venus. You know, when Venus got to the finals of the U.S. Open, you know, as an unseeded teenager in 97, and it was all about Venus and Venus, you know, and Richard Williams, who was, you know, just a genius and as sly as a fox, you know, he always used to put up his finger and he always used to say, but Serena's better. And everybody was like, yeah, whatever, you know. And then here comes Serena, and then she's the one who's the Williams sister who wins the first major. So in 1999, before Venus. So that was kind of like rocking the boat there, where everybody was expecting Venus to break through, but it was Serena that broke through. And then, I mean, I think people will remember seeing, you know, Venus in the player's box, and she had her hoodie on, and it was kind of hiding under the hoodie, and people were kind of questioning whether she felt like she should be the one that was there and so forth. And then, you know, Venus really, you know, was the number one player in the world and was the flag bearer for women's tennis there in the early 2000s. And then, you know, then Serena came through and beat her in 2002 in the final, in the prime time U.S. Open final. And then she kind of, you know, took over you know, from there. But yeah, that's the one thing that people don't kind of forget is that, you know, it really was Venus first. I mean, I worked with both girls at the 2000 Olympics in Sydney, and Venus had just won the US Open in Wimbledon. And Serena was kind of like going around to all the events. She was only playing doubles that year. She only qualified in doubles in 2000 for the Olympics. And she was going around the village and to all these events, and no one really paid her much mind. I mean, she just went around just as anonymous can be. And then, you know, gosh, fast forward to today, and, you know, she's probably the most famous woman in the world.
And then in that much anticipated 2002 final, Serena beat her sister Venus, who had won the, you know, she was the two-time defending champion Venus at that point. And it was actually a rematch of the previous year's final. And you know, what made that win even more historic was that Serena was in the midst of the Serena Slam, right? Winning all four major singles titles, starting with the 2002 French Open, the 2002 Wimbledon, the 2002 US Open, the 2003 Australian Open, in that non-calendar year. But yeah, that, you know, just remember how much anticipation it was when the two would meet, particularly in the final. And Serena prevailed to win her second US Open title back then.
Yeah, no, I mean, that primetime U.S. Open final was really perfect. I mean, it was the year before, which was the first year of the primetime final, when it was Venus and Serena, you know, playing in the final, which, you know, couldn't have been scripted any better. But yeah, no, I mean, Serena's, you know, a lot of her career has been defined at the U.S. Open, not just because of the victories, but she's just had some super famous and controversial losses. You know, she was going for the, you know, the calendar year Grand Slam in 2015 and lost in what might be the biggest upset in tennis history, losing to Roberta Vinci. You know, there was the famous loss to Naomi Osaka, which, you know, was headlines around the world with the controversy with the coaching and the point penalty that she got, or the game penalty that she got. You know, she lost a very controversial match to Kim Clijsters in the semifinals, when she, you know, threw some audible obscenities at a lines person and got a point penalty down match point, you know, which cost her that match. And she lost the U.S. Open final to Sam Stosur when there was a infamous hindrance call. You know, there's I posted an article on worldtennismagazine.com that highlight all the amazing wins that Serena had at the U.S. Open, but also some of the, you know, very controversial and high profile losses that she had there. So, I mean, gosh, Serena and the U.S. Open, I mean, that's those two events and players. I mean, they just go together. And it's just, you know, super appropriate that, you know, she's saying so long to tennis here in New York in front of all of her fans in New York City. And I'll tell you, that 2019 final against Bianca Andreescu, when she was, you know, gunning to tie Margaret Court's record, and she was down a set in 5-2 and was coming back to tie it at 5-all. I've been to the U.S. Open for, you know, 30, 40 years. I have never heard a crowd louder than that crowd that was cheering for Serena to come back against Andreescu. And Andreescu says, like, it was so loud I couldn't even think. But but boy, I think the ovation's going to be just as loud, or almost as loud, when she takes the court for her finale here in New
York.
Well,
those meltdowns that you enumerated, I mean, obviously, you know, we were both there. We watched in disbelief. I mean, going back to 2009 when she was playing that semifinal against Kim Clijsters, and she basically threatened to shove a tennis ball down the lineswoman's throat. I mean, I was shocked, but maybe not really, because Serena plays with so much emotion and really had that kind of chip on her shoulder that she was out to prove everybody wrong and that everybody at one point was against her. And I think that fueled her passion and her will to win, right? I mean, we just saw so many of those moments at the U.S. Open. And then again, you mentioned the final in 2018 against Naomi Osaka. I mean, yelling at the umpire, "I've never cheated. You owe me an apology." And she was, you know, calling the umpire a thief. And then later her coach did indeed admit that he did give Serena hand signals, you know, whether or not Serena was really watching and taking those advice, that advice, you know, it's illegal, right? But it was wild that after that match, her own coach even admitted that, yes, he was coaching her.
Well, you know, one of the things that I just love about Serena Williams is she hates to lose. She is a capital C champion because she absolutely hates to lose. And when she's losing or on the verge of losing, she is so riled up. And that's what made her such a great champion. You know, her early coach was Rick Macy, and he wrote a book that I published, Macy Magic, Extracting Greatness from Yourself and Others. And he describes early Serena and just saying, boy, she is a fighter. She is a fighter. And he said, if she doesn't, you know, if you don't see her succeeding on the tennis court, she's going to be in juvenile court because she's just such a street fighter on the tennis court. And that's how Serena played. And that's why she was such a champion. And that's why I love her, because, you know, you just want somebody that just hates to lose. And Serena hates to lose. And that's why she was a great champion. And that's why
she basically laid it all out there, wearing her heart on her sleeve. And, you know, and then she was able, though, in that Osaka match, Randy, to basically then hug Naomi afterwards. And when Naomi thought that, you know, the crowd was booing, you know, against her, who winning her first major, against her hero, Serena Williams, but she was able to turn that moment into actually more of a positive moment, which I think is just uncanny. I mean, here is the greatest ever to play the game, right, in the women's game. And she kind of turns around her issues and her emotional outbursts into more of a positive, right? Do you ever notice that? I mean, it's amazing how she was able to do that all these years.
Yeah, that was about as awkward as a post-match post-match on-court ceremony as there's ever been. But, you know, I mean, via social media and Instagram and so forth, when we were able to see, you know, the other side of Serena, you know, the charming, you know, mom and just, you know, what a wonderful, caring, intellectual, smart, you know, caring person she is. And, you know, certainly when you were in that situation, I mean, obviously they weren't booing, you know, Osaka, and Serena wanted to make sure that everybody knew that. And, you know, Serena, she knew that, you know, despite the penalty and so forth, I mean, she was getting outplayed. I mean, Osaka just beat her, and that was the, you know, the story. So, I mean, she wasn't using that as an excuse at all. I mean, Osaka beat her, and that's, you know, and Osaka deserved to have her moment in the moment of glory, which unfortunately she didn't have that year. But, you know, Osaka went on to win another U.S. Open and, you know, two Australian titles. So she's been able to, you know, raise her hands and triumph and so forth. But
Randy, let's talk about Serena Williams and really what made her such a dominant force on the court as far as her game. I mean, she overpowered 90% of her opponents, right?
The greatest serve in women's tennis history. I mean, her serve was such a weapon, you know, perhaps the most lethal weapon in the history of women's tennis. You know, that was you know, the big weapon that made her the champion. But obviously, you know, bruising ground strokes and, you know, and she played doubles too. You know, she had a great volley and she has the swinging volleys and so forth, but she just, you know, overpowered, most of her opponents. But, you know, singularly, it's her serve.
Singularly, it was her serve, her overpowering ground strokes. She moved very quickly for being a big woman. She moves very quickly, great anticipation. And as you say, really, mentally, she just refused to lose. And she found ways to come back. She was just a great fighter. I hate to talk about her in past tense. I mean, she's still going to be playing at the U.S. Open. Hopefully, you know, we'll see her go through the draw a little bit here at the U.S. Open. But I just think her sheer power just overwhelmed the majority of the other women out there.
Yeah, I mean, you see, you know, recently when she lost matches this summer, and you just look at her face when, you know, she loses those matches, and she's, you know, really mad, you know, that she lost. And, you know, that will that champion's will, that she's just going to will herself to victories. And, you know, not all of her victories were, 6-2, 6-3, bulldoze final. I mean, she gutted out, you know, and came back. I mean, Victoria Azarenka served for the U.S. Open title against her, and I think it was 2012 or 2013, you know, and Serena said in her post-match press conference, she says, I was preparing my runner-up speech on what I was going to say, you know. So, I mean, she nearly came back and forced a third set against Andreescu in 2019. She's a fighter. I mean, you look back at her record and, you know, her major victories and so forth. I mean, she gutted out and came back from the brink, you know, several times to win titles.
And her background, you know, growing up, she and Venus and the whole family in Compton, California, and, you know, King Richard, obviously so beautifully depicted in the film that won a lot of awards during, the Hollywood award season. Her background, just where she came from and her father's coaching methods and philosophy. I mean, it's just an incredible story. It's almost too unreal, right?
Yeah, but it's the greatest story in the history of sports, you know.
I think it is.
Probably beyond sports, but yeah, King Richard movie is, you know, depicts that very well. And, you know, gosh, I mean, Richard Williams, what a genius on raising those two young women to be, elite champions, you know, two of the greatest women sports athletes of all time. And, you know, also just, the education and, you know, just how smart they are and how educated they are. And, about talking about things that, a lot of journalists in the press room were stumped to, even engage with a discussion with, but
he did it his way, and he made sure that they were absolutely ready before they entered the pro game, and he'd hand select the tournaments that they played in,
they did play junior tournaments. I mean, that was the thing that was super crazy was, you know, they played some of those 10 and under and 12 and under tournaments, which is depicted in the King Richard movie. But then he pulled them out. He pulled both of them out of junior tennis. And, they didn't play any USTA National Junior Championships or ITF Junior Championships or Junior Wimbledon or Junior US.
Why do you think that was the case? What was his reasoning behind that?
I think, you know, it was kind of discussed a little bit in the King Richard movie where, you know, he just kind of saw this kind of, you know, the dark side of junior tennis with, you know, overbearing parents eating and burned out and all that kind of stuff.
Plus he didn't want the competitors out there to really, you know, see how good they were developing. And when they came or when they arrived on the pro scene, they were a surprise to everybody, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, that might be part of it too. I mean, Venus made her debut at the, in Oakland, California in 1994 and won a round and, you know, should have beaten Arantxa Sanchez in the second round, got tight and so forth, which is, you know, fictionalized in the movie. Serena, the story in Wall Street Journal, which is pretty famous, you know, her first pro match was in the qualifying rounds of a WTA event in Quebec City. And she lost, I think it was 6-1, 6-1 to Annie Miller, you know, who was kind of a, you know, barely top 100, 18-year-old, player. So it kind of, you know, took a little bit, you know, a little bit for them to get accustomed. And, one thing that's kind of not really, you know, discussed that I was at, which was they were both at a USTA player development training camp in Key Biscayne, Florida, which I think in 94, 90, 93 or 94. They were playing, you know, practice matches against the top juniors. And I do remember specifically Serena struggling, you know, to play some of her peers, lost. I think she lost a practice match to a player named Kim Gates, who was, you know, the top 14 and under in the country at the time, once they got acclimated in pro tennis and, they started to dominate. You know, Venus made her U.S. Open debut in 97, and then, you know, Serena in 1998. And then, you know, Serena won the US Open in her second appearance in the tournament in 99, you know, as a 17-year-old.
Serena made the announcement that this would be her final US Open in the September issue of Vogue magazine. And in that essay that she wrote, she said she never liked the word retirement. She said she's really evolving away from tennis. And I'm not surprised. She's been injured. She's been dealing with, you know, a lot of injuries for a long time. But a year ago at Wimbledon, she pulled a hamstring. And really, I was surprised she came back and played Wimbledon this year. She said in the essay that a conversation she had with Tiger Woods kind of really got her excited again and prompted her to go out and start training and maybe, you know, make a major comeback. But look, she's going to be 41, right? She has basically said Olympia wants to be a bigger, an older sister. Serena has said she wants to expand her family. There's really no reason for her to continue playing. It's, you know, she's obviously wants to be considered the greatest of all time and has said that because she hasn't tied Margaret Court's 24 major singles titles, she's, you know, she feels that, you know, she would have loved to have done that, but I don't see her doing that, even if she did stay in the game at this point in her career, Randy. So, I mean, she really has nothing to apologize for. She's had just an incredible career. And I think it's going to be a very compelling US Open to see her, how she does this year. And I'm sure she'll go out smiling and with, you know, big fanfare with the fans here in New York who just adore her.
Well, you know, when, you know, there's that, you know, she hobbled off center court at Wimbledon with that injury. And, you know, you just don't want that to be the final image in the career of Serena Williams. You know, you want to see her, you know, walk off the court, waving to everybody, having played a, you know, a great match, you know, I mean, I'm not sure that she's going to, you know, walk off and like Pete Sampras did 20 years ago with a victory. But, you know, if she could win a couple matches and, you know, play against a great player, I mean, I think, you know, you look at a lot of players and, you know, that they had very dignified exits, you know, whether it's, you know, Chris Evert, you know, losing to Zena Garrison, or, you know, Andy Roddick at the US Open, you know, losing to Juan Martín Del Potro, you know, Jimmy Connors' last match was against Yvonne Lendl, you know, John McEnroe's last match was against Jim Courier. You know, so you know, Martina Navratilova walked off with a mixed doubles title with Bob Bryan at almost 50 years old. So you want to see somebody of Serena's stature, you know, go out with a dignified exit, you know, whatever that may be, but certainly not, you know, hobbling off crying on center court at Wimbledon. So, you know, hey, she lost to Harmony Tan in the first round of Wimbledon, but, you know, it was an exciting match. And, you know, certainly that's more dignified than walking off with an injury. And, you know, we'll see what happens here at the US Open, but it's going to be in front of, you know, almost 25,000 screaming fans who love and adore her and are going to show their appreciation for everything that she's done, you know, for tennis and women's sports and women in general. And, you know, she's going to have the send off that she deserves. And she's going to, you know, gosh, she's going to have another 40 years of amazing contributions to society, you know, after tennis, you know, as a mother, as a businesswoman, as an icon, you know, so that's going to be exciting too, to see what's going to happen in the next 40 years.
Absolutely. I think, you know, the best years of her life could be in front of her. You know, she has Serena Ventures. She's investing in women owned companies. Again, she wants to extend her family. She's very involved in fashion but, you know, knowing when to say goodbye, if you're a superstar athlete, is really one of the most difficult decisions ever. I mean, obviously look at Tom Brady. He recently turned 45. He unretired 40 days after he retired and he'll be playing in his 23rd NFL season. So it's very, very tough when you're at, you know, the top of your game, right? To know exactly when to say goodbye.
Well, I wrote an article on WorldTennisMagazine.com comparing, you know, how the three great champions, you know, of recent times, you know, had their swan song and how they retired, you know, Chris Evert, Martina Navratilova, and Steffi Graf, and they each kind of handled it differently. You know, Chris Evert, I think, was the most similar to Serena, where, you know, she kind of felt like, okay, it's the end, and she wanted to have her first child, and, you know, kind of was wishy-washy, and then finally, just before the U.S. Open, she had an article in Sports Illustrated where she came out and said, I'm going to retire at the U.S. Open. This is going to be my last U.S. Open. And then she had the great swan song at the U.S. Open. And then Martina, you know, kind of did the same thing. And then she got to the finals of Wimbledon a little bit unexpectedly. And then she decided, okay, that might be my last major. And she skipped the U.S. Open, actually, ironically, and just kind of finished out the year and played at Madison Square Garden. And they, you know, raised the banner, you know, Martina banner at Madison Square Garden. And then a couple of years later, she got kind of antsy. She's like, yeah, I want to play again. You know, so she started playing a little bit more singles and played doubles for many more years, won a few more majors, you know, until she was almost 50. And then there's Steffi Graf, you know, who, you know, dramatically and unexpectedly won the French Open in 1999, you know, started her romance there with Andre Agassi, who also won the French Open that year, got to the finals of the French Open. And she started kind of saying like, okay, this is probably going to be my last majors, but didn't really make any kind of commitment. Just said, this is probably going to be the last time I play here, etc. And then she played a tournament in San Diego and got hurt and had to retire. And then she was like, okay, that's it. I'm out. No, you know, flowers and ceremony, whatever. I'm just going to have a press conference here in Heidelberg and I'm out, you know. And then she got married to Andre and had kids and so forth. So, I mean, it's a gripping decision. I mean, like, if this is your whole life, you know, professional sports and you're a lead and you just don't want to hang it up, you know, and even Andy Roddick, you know, when he announced his retirement at the 2012 U.S. Open, he just kind of decided right there. I remember he, you know, went up to my former coworker, Tim Curry, and was like, hey, you need to organize a press conference tomorrow because the day after tomorrow is going to be my last match and I'm retiring, you know. So
No fanfare there.
Yeah. So, I mean, but he had a little bit of fanfare there, but he just kind of, you know, it's a difficult situation. And I know Serena had been wrestling with that for a while and, you know, we're grateful that she decided to, you know, play a few more events and have one more crack at Wimbledon to say goodbye and one more crack here at the U.S. Open to say goodbye.
So here's a number that is astounding to me. 39 combined major titles for Serena Williams, including singles, her 23 singles title at major titles, doubles and mixed. I mean, that's just crazy number, right?
Crazy number. And then, you know, also she won, you know, Olympic gold, and then she won Olympic gold in doubles with her sister three times. You know,
so, I mean, if anybody's questioning, you know, the fact that she didn't tie Margaret Court's 24, I mean, just look at everything else she's done.
Well, I mean, there's apples and oranges with Margaret Court, you know, as far as, you know, some of those early Australian Opens had like, you know, 32 and 64 draws. And, you know, a lot of them, you know, it was some years it was only Australians. I think I wrote an article on that in worldtennismagazine.com, you know, a few years ago, kind of comparing, you know, or Margaret Court's, you know, majors victories, you know, versus Serena's and just, you know, what the draw sizes were and so forth. So, you know, you're always going to get apples and oranges. You're going to get that also with, you know, comparing, you know, Novak to Rafa to Roger to Rod Laver to Bill Tilden, you know, et cetera. So, you know, I mean, if you just kind of compare the Open era, you know, it's Serena. I mean, Margaret Court won a lot more, you know, doubles and mixed doubles titles than Serena did, but, you know, it was just a different era. So, you know, I think we should just, you know, you can call Serena the greatest, you know, but you could say Margaret Court is the most accomplished, you know, or the most, you know.
Well, I mean, that would be even be hard to say most accomplished because of everything that Serena has accomplished throughout her legendary career. And, you know, and just in closing, Randy Walker, you know, really thinking of every athlete I've ever covered and probably any personality you've ever focused on in your publishing and PR career, I can't think of any other personality who's had more of an impact, male or female, than Serena Williams.
Yeah, I think in recent times, for sure, it's been Serena. I would, you know, put in the name Billie Jean King in there as well. I mean, she.
Sure, as far as the visionary goes, but I'm saying as far as what her accomplishments have been on and off the court.
Yeah, no, I think Billie Jean, you know, certainly would be, you know, there with every sports foundation and, you know, creating the WTA tour and everything that she's done for equality and society and so forth. But Serena and Venus, you know, were the, you know, took the torch, you know, from Billie Jean on that and will continue to, you know, take the torch there and, you know, fight for women's rights and equality and, you know, women owned businesses, as you mentioned, and so forth. I mean, it is going to be really exciting to see what Serena does, you know, with her business life in the next, you know, 40 years. But certainly in this era of big media and social media and Instagram and so forth, I mean, Serena is just so viral and, you know, her fame around the world. I mean, you could argue that, you know, Serena Williams might be the most famous woman in the world. You know, but, you know, Billie Jean's era, you know, it was mainly just, you know, newspapers and, you know, your 30 minute news every night on your, you know, four channels that you get on TV. But certainly in this era of social media and, you know, the internet and so forth, I mean, you could say that Serena is the most viral, you know, sensation in women's sports.
Sure. And overcoming barriers as a Black female athlete, and,
absolutely,
and encouraging people of color to take up the sport and inspiring really men and women of all ages and of all backgrounds with all the her comebacks from injuries and you know some of the illnesses that she overcame and the pregnancy issues, and you know she almost died with the pulmonary issues, right? So well, I mean
you talk about, you know, I mean that's one thing that really, you know, we haven't discussed, and you know, just what an impact both Venus and Serena had on minorities playing tennis around the world, not just the United States. I mean, you see, I mean, they, when they first came up, I mean, they were pretty much the only two Black players, you know, and now you have so many different players of different backgrounds and you know, so many more African-American players, you know, playing tennis, and that's the Venus and Serena effect. And you talk to those players and they say, well, I got into tennis because Venus and Serena. And, you know, I think the other thing is just, you know, the fact that she did come back as a mother. I mean, she's certainly not the only, you know, woman who has had a baby and come back and won, you know, major championships. I mean, you know, Yvonne Goolagong and Margaret Court and, you know, Kim Clijsters and Vika Azarenka has, you know, been coming back too. But what an inspiration that is, you know, for a woman to, you know, continue her career and continue her athletic career after having a baby. And, you know, she hasn't won a major singles title, you know, since she, you know, had Olympia. But I mean, how many major finals did she get to? I mean, she just came, you know, a little bit short each time, but.
And she was 2 months pregnant when she won her last major title, the 2017 Australian Open. Randy Walker, thanks so much. You are a walking encyclopedia of tennis, and I so appreciate your insight on the legendary Serena Williams.
Thank you, Ann. Pleasure to be with you.
Always a pleasure. My thanks to sports and nutrition coach Damon Goddard, to tennis historian Randy Walker, to Mike Goodsell in production. Here's a quote from Oprah Winfrey that I recently read. If you look at what you have in life, you'll always have more. If you look at what you don't have in life, you'll never have enough. Hope you enjoyed this show. Have a wonderful weekend, everybody. Be safe, be nice. And I'll talk to you next Saturday morning right here on Sports Interview with Ann Liguori.